Welcome to another episode of the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told, and where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors, a clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin.
58. Look at
that. We're laughing from the get-go. So it's a great privilege to welcome to the Good Listening To podcast, Clearing Today, a man who I can only describe as being a beautiful lyrical man. I've been really enjoying researching up to today to bring the lovely Paul Dodgson here into the Good Listening To podcast, Clearing. He's written a wonderful book, very lyrical of itself, and some of the songs I've been listening to, Poppy's song, by the way, is just a perfect song, I think, and I hope you'll tell us a bit about that. But the Good Listening To podcast is the place where all good stories come to be told and all good questions come to be asked. And I'm the, I suppose, author and curator of this very exciting, energetic space called The Clearing. And so Paul Dodgson, who is a writer, a life writer. When I read that, I thought that's quite interesting, because when you think of life art, is whether or not we do it naked or not. I'm sure you don't always feel the need to write naked, but I'm sure you have.
We'll so, go yes. into that later, yeah.
So yes, you're really welcome. And, you know, you're beautifully lyrical. I just want to share with you some of the lyrics later on that I saw that really, really caught my heart in working up to bringing you into the place today. But anyway, Paul Dodgson, welcome. How are you? What's your story of the day?
So thank you very much indeed. It's lovely to be here. And I suppose if I'm thinking of my story of the day, it is actually, do you know what it is? It's the story of the day is I was thinking about when we first met.
Okay.
And I bet you don't remember. Can you remember when we first met?
Well, you've been on my awareness radar for many, many years. And we have many, many people in common. We've got Kate Cross, who yes. I met way back when at the beginning of my career. And in fact, even this morning, reading about that as I was flicking through your book, it reminded me that there's another actor that has just recently said yes, and he was around about the same time. There's all these connections. It's an actor called Colin Hurley, but anyway, there are lots of connections. But I think I've known you for about 20 years.
You have, yeah. It's actually longer than that. And in fact, I looked it up because I can remember the occasion. We were both auditioned for a radio production of Cider with Rosie.
Wow.
In 1998, in the same room by a producer called Viv Beebe.
Yes.
who produced and directed that series. And we were both asked to read for the same part. We both ended up in it, because I've just looked this up. And
yeah.
I played the vicar, and I think you played various other parts.
Yes.
And interestingly, this was 1998, and it's about to be repeated on Radio 4 Extra in March. Yeah.
And Viv Beebe is that other connection, because you subsequently went on to produce Poetry Please, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yes, that's right. I was a producer there anyway, and I'd sort of begun acting and then ended up producing, and so I was kind of creeping back into acting again.
Okay, I like that expression, creeping back. And by the way, what's so wonderful about your book, On the Road Not Taken, obviously it has resonances of, I'm assuming, the road less travelled might be where you're going slightly, but I so love, have you heard of something called desire lines, by the way?
No, I haven't.
If you're on the beaten path of something, how often people will go off-piste and there'll be a new, brand new track, which the architect of whichever space weren't expecting, which are called desire lines, where you think, oh, do you know what? I'd rather go this way. And desire lines are a really nice path. So what's lovely about your book is that I was really struck with the fact there's a journey to authenticity, how you delayed coming to the clearing, if you like, of what you really wanted to do by almost 40 years.
Yes.
But as we know, your desire lines to have gone somewhere else are not a waste of life. They're just different choices. Hmm. So it's really profound because of all the notions of you know, sliding door moments in our life. And even in your book, you tell a beautiful story about a moment when you're about to, in a hotel in New York, go to bed. But instead, as the lift is about to open, you clock somebody who raises a glass to you in a bar. And then, you know, maybe you're going to tell us about this, but that results in a most spontaneous and beautiful evening.
Yes. And I end up singing Fairy Tale of New York in a bar in Greenwich Village.
Yes. Yeah. So listen, there's lots to talk about, but I really want you to just take this wherever you want to. So I'm going to take you through the normal route map, as I've started to discover is the best way to do this. So we'll talk about a clearing first of all, then we'll talk about the tree within your clearing. We'll shake your tree. There'll be alchemy, gold, and then there'll be a cake with a cherry on the top as well at the end. So if people don't have a reference to you, I know there's a clue to you because you often walk with a guitar over your shoulder.
Yes.
Even your book has that, if I showed up to the screen as well, that lovely sort of quintessential musician iconography. So if people don't have reference for you, but they just meet you, like this chap in the hotel lobby in New York might meet you. When people ask you that rather clunky question, hello, you look interesting, what do you do? What's your favourite way of answering that?
Well, probably the most accurate thing I could say would be a story engineer. But that's not really an accepted profession yet. But what by that I mean, I kind of work on stories, and I have done throughout my professional life as a radio producer, as a teacher, as a script writing and writing mentor, and as a writer myself of scripts, of screenplays, and now this book. So all and of course music in the form of songs, both in the theatre and also in songs that I just write for myself and put out into the world. So it's all of those things. And if I wanted to find an umbrella term, I think it would be story engineer.
That's so beautifully put. I've never heard anyone, it makes such profound sense, and I've never heard anyone say it like that. So, you know, you should copyright that. You are a story engineer. I just adore that. That's wonderful. And indeed, you know, again, your book, please talk about it as much as you want.
Yes.
It's brilliant to flick through, by the way. I've just found all sorts of magical moments. So anyway, that is now time to bring you into a place called the clearing. So what is a clearing like for you? So where do you go, Paul Dodgson, to get clutter-free, innovative and able to think?
Well, I think to start with, I would say I am very cluttered. I'm naturally very cluttered. As I'm talking to you now, and I'm trying to talk in a straight line about the clearing, there are 100 other things coming in, and I could so easily digress and talk about something else completely and actually not tell a very well engineered story at all. And that is the way my mind is. And so I find it very difficult to concentrate. I always have done. It became apparent round about A-level time when you start needing to concentrate for long periods of time. I found it difficult. I did a degree. I found that difficult. I'm amazed I've ever done anything at all. But,
but you've done many, many things.
I have ended up doing a lot of different things, yeah. A jack of all trades. But what the clearing is for me now, I have discovered, is running. I run. And when I get up in the morning, my mind is all over the place. I'm a mess of half constructed thoughts, and I go running 6 days a week. I go out and I force myself out. That my mind is saying, don't bother, stay at home, pour yourself a cup of coffee, just go upstairs, just have a little look on the internet. And I have to force myself out of the door and I run. And within half an hour, I'm out of the woods and I'm in the clearing. And it's just the most wonderful thing. And it stays with me to a certain extent all day.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears. Beef and Skittles. Cider with Rosie. Common or garden. Ant and deck. Fish and chips. Mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
Beautiful stuff. I also, have you heard that expression, life is a wicked mess? I love the fact that as a story engineer, your head is just full of clutter, but running gets it out of your head and into
it. It is amazing. And how I discovered this was, I'd run, occasionally I'd run, and in my 30s, I think, and I'd feel afterwards, I'd feel profoundly different. And I think that's interesting. And then, there was a point where I read a review of a book called What I Talk About When I Talk About Running by the Japanese novelist Haruki Murakami. And he wrote this quite slim little memoir, really, about running and writing and the connection between the two and how writing a novel or a long book is like running a marathon. And when I read this book, it just made sense. Now, the interesting thing was that the review that I read, it was in the Independent newspaper, and it was written by Alistair Campbell, the Tony Blair's director of communications and spin doctor in chief, and he had suffered. I have suffered from depression at various points in my life, and he has too. And I know that running is part of his strategy. And it kind of all made sense. And I remember I was working at Salisbury Playhouse just after as I was reading this book, and I was on it was a tech week in a theatre. And I was involved in from 10 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, not moving very much. And so instead of just getting up, having breakfast and going in, I'd go out for a run every day that week, first of all around the water meadows. And the difference was so profound, I couldn't believe it. And I didn't start running every day at that point. It kind of took a little while to get to that stage. And but the effect is profound, and it's and extraordinary, and it settles everything down. And then some years later, I was running an event at a literary festival down in Cornwall, in a little Cornish village. And I got up early in the morning, and I thought I would go for a run before my event. And there was a man in the distance I could see. I didn't know where I was, a very hilly place by the coast. And so I thought I'd follow this man. And so I followed him, and he went out through the lanes and round and back. And as I drew back into the town, I caught up with him, and it was Alistair Campbell.
Oh.
Who was down speaking. So I was able to say to him, I'm running because of you.
Good grief. And by the way, as you were speaking about Alistair Campbell, I remember about, I read about his depression and how he would, in your Monsters of Distraction, getting you to go upstairs or have another coffee rather than running. I remember a story about him walking down a corridor in his house, wherever it was, and his instinctive decision to open his curtains or not would inform him subliminally about whether his depression, if he was feeling dark, was going to take over. If he could just open the curtains, it means that he was in the day.
Yes.
But that's so extraordinary that he is your inspirer, and then you find yourself running alongside him.
Yeah, amazing.
And the chaos that you've experienced in your mind, it sounds to me, as a story engineer, you've got lots of desire lines going on in your head, is what I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was young, when I was at school and people would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? I could never settle on any one thing. And so what actually has happened is that I haven't settled on one thing. It's lots of different things, but there is a common route. But that works best for me.
And at the point you are in your life now, when you look back, you know, that beauty of the gift of hindsight, can you see the golden thread that's weaved, you know, albeit a sort of a big snaking of a narrative, but can you see the sort of ley lines towards now that all make sense?
Yeah, I can. It does make sense. It does make sense. And I'll probably talk a little bit more about that as we go on, actually.
Sure. So we're running, and if I may, I'm going to run alongside you now.
While you're talking, can I pour a coffee?
Please do. So you're running along, and I'm there with you now, and I've arrived with a tree. So it's quite difficult to up with you as I sort of heft after you with the tree. And we're going to shake your tree in the clearing to see which storytelling apples fall out.
Yes.
Now, this is the 5-4-3-2-1 exercise where you've had about 5 minutes or as long as you needed, Paul Dodgson, to think about four things that have shaped you, three things that inspire you, two things that never fail to grab your attention, a bit, squirrels, a bit like the borrowed from the Up reference there, and then one quirky or unusual fact about you we couldn't possibly know until you tell us. So it's just to get you on the open road of desire lines of stories you'd like to tell with the thread of that as your stimulus. So go wherever you like within the structure of me shaking your tree to see which apples fall out.
Over okay. Well, I think it's interesting. I automatically want to head towards a kind of chronological narrative within the four things. So I will do that. And I'm going to start with home. Home for me was a house in Kent, a modest detached house in a place called Hythe, which is a little town on the coast of Kent. And it's slightly unusual. I was an only child, and I had a slightly unusual childhood in that my parents never moved. So that's the first house that I can remember. And the house was eventually sold when my mum moved into a care home 2 years ago. Oh, so in all that time, this place has been there.
As a constant.
Yeah, and so whenever somebody says to you, wherever you are in the world, and somebody says, hey, where's home? My thought would always be Hythe, this little house in Hythe in Kent. And it was a lovely place to grow up. And I often think when I watch documentaries about the 1970s, there's usually kind of bleak bomb sites, still strangely often in black and white, but strange kind of almost apocalyptic landscapes of decay. And it just wasn't like that in Hythe. It was a nice, genteel little town on the coast, looking out across the sea to France. And that's where I grew up, and it nurtured me and supported me, as did mum and dad. But at the same time, it was a very organized place. So I think of my parents, use a metaphor, I think that my parents' life was like an organized tour. They knew where they were staying. They knew how they were going to get there, and they knew what they were going to eat on the whole when they got there. You know, it was all sorted out, and it was very organized, and it functioned really well for them. And I think I sort of reacted against that. And I feel like, to continue the metaphor, I've been backpacking. I've had a kind of one-way ticket, and I've spent a lot of time sleeping in ferry ports and railway stations, metaphorically.
And were you tempted in the constancy after your mum passed away, were you tempted to take the house on, or you knew that that was just the end of an era?
Well, my mum hasn't passed away. She's in a care home.
Sorry.
No, my father has, but my mum is in a care home now.
Right.
And so in order to pay the care home, to support the care home fees, we had to sell the house. Uh-huh. I wouldn't have been tempted, though, because I've left there now. I live in Cardiff now, and that's my home. And that's the past. It was a sad thing. It was a strange and sad thing to see it go. And the last week, I may well write about that in the future, actually, about the last week in the house, because it was a strange thing as I went through the archaeology of my parents' possessions and had to throw almost everything away.
Do you mind asking how long ago your father passed away?
Yeah, that was in 2001, so that's nearly 20 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I think that in terms of shaping, the stability of it kind of and safety of it gave me something to react against and gave me possibly the confidence to be less so in my own life. And maybe that moves on to the next thing, because that's where you
which
I wanted to talk about I want to keep the chronology, so I'm going to stick with the chronology. I'm going to talk about the BBC. Lovely. Okay, I got a job in 1986, so I did a degree in drama, theatre and television studies. And I got very interested in sound recording when I was there.
And where was that, Paul?
Degree? It was in a place called King Alfred's College in Winchester, which is now the University of Winchester. It's been upgraded. So it depends who you're talking to. People say, where did you go to? And you might say, University of Winchester, or you might say King Alfred's College.
Okay. I like the historic. King Alfred sounds more historic.
It was a teacher training college originally.
Yeah.
And it expanded into a liberal arts college in the 70s, actually. And started doing these other degrees. And we had amazing, you know, it was an amazing place. There was a TV studio there, and before there were any, you know, portable video cameras and things. They would have these things called porta packs that you could sign out. And
I remember.
You remember those things? Great big things that you would
hefting things.
Hefty thing that you'd have over your shoulder that with a wire that connected to a camera on your shoulder, and you go wandering around with that with very limited battery life.
And forgive me for sidetracking you slightly, but you said you got a job seminally at the BBC.
Yes, and then I got a job at the BBC. I got a job as a studio manager initially at the BBC. They used to have a training scheme for people to come into the BBC, and it was a way of getting in. It was quite a, you know, I studied the odds and worked out how I could get this job. And I realized that, you know, I applied for it while I was still at college and didn't get in, but I had the experience of going for a board, and I sort of realized all the ingredients that I needed. And so over the next year, actually spent time learning enough physics so I could confidently say how a microphone works. Understanding current affairs enough to be able to know what the major stories were, to be able to listen to enough radio drama to understand how it was made.
Yes.
And just learn about things so that when they said to me, tell me what's the most important story today, I could say, I know. It's, you know, and then when they said in the interview, tell me about, you know, how does magnetic tape actually work?
I knew
all these things. And I got in as a trainee studio manager, and it was a great training. And I ended up I did a little bit of time at Broadcasting House, but I then ended up at the World Service. And I think now of my time at the BBC, because I was initially a studio manager and then a producer at the BBC from between 1986 to 2001. Mm-hmm. I think of that as actually my university. It was the university of the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned so much through my encounters with the people that I met. And so initially in the World Service, the World Service in those days was primarily broadcasting on shortwave all around the world. And there were 36, I think, different language services. And you would be given your job would be to turn up 15 minutes before a transmission, and for a very kind of harried frustrated and chaotic presenter to come running in with tapes and records and scripts in Pashto maybe, or Mandarin or Russian.
Yes.
And they'd hand it all to you, and you'd have 15 minutes to kind of make sense of it, get it on air. And
how could you do that if it's all coming at you in sort of multilinguistic packages of information?
Well, they most scripts you can follow. Mandarin and Russian are harder, but most others are. And even after a while, you began to get the sense of pace of scripts in Russian and Mandarin. Wow. You didn't know, you know, what was going on. But and then there would be hand signals. So you just needed to know that it was that tape one, band one was first, and then tape two, band one was next. And as long as everything was in the right order, they would be reading and then they would go like that and you would play in the tape. And if it was the right one, it all was good. If it was the wrong one, they'd kind of go like that and you'd be.
So the power of body language to read, yes, whether or not you're being a good producer. I love that.
But these people were amazing, and they were often, had escaped difficult regimes in their home countries to end up in the UK and become broadcasters. And so they were all really interesting people. And so I ended up learning so much about the world. And so I do think of it as the university of the BBC. And then I became a producer initially for the music, the pop music unit, it was called in the World Service.
Pop music unit.
And the pop music unit had various programs that were made every week, including people like Dave Lee Travis, who would come in the radio one DJ and do something. But amongst these were there was a youth program for youth called Megamix, and I got to produce this. And it was a magazine program. And one of the first things they did when I started there was to say, look, what you need to do, what we want is a live broadcast from New York. So you've got to go out and do that. And so that was the first sort of foreign trip I had. And it was the most amazing thing to sort of be, having watched New York on screen and read about it all my life, to then suddenly go there and have this ticket to kind of get you into places.
Yes.
And the BBC in those days had an office, had a suite of offices and studios high up in the Rockefeller Center in Manhattan.
Lovely.
And you'd walk in through the door and there'd be this sort of Manhattan skyscape behind you, and you'd really feel like you were something.
Being from the UK as well, and the sort of love the Americans stereotypically have of the British, I'm from the BBC, and then you're in Manhattan.
it was interesting, yeah. But then to bring it down to earth, we put this program together and it went out live, and it was a fairly amazing experience. And it was, you know, you knew that a phenomenal amount of people were listening to it, you know, millions of people around the world on shortwave in Nigeria and in Russia and in all over the place would be crouched around these little shortwave radios listening to you, partly because they would write to us and tell us. Anyway, we finished this program and we were on a real high, and we went down to a cocktail bar over the road. It was a Monday night and it was completely empty. And the presenter went up to the bar and said, we want to have two cocktails because we've just broadcast to 50 million people. And the barman just kind of looked at us and says, is that so?
What more need he say? Just right. Yes. And brilliant. And you're so enabling other people's work during all this time. And I know, because of the book On the Road Not Taken, somewhere in your narrative you're also wanting to be a musician. That's sort of something.
Yes, absolutely. So the thing about being a producer is, and I was a producer in the World Service, and then I came to Bristol to work on a program there. That's what brought me to Bristol in 1991 to work and ended up working on various programs, drama, documentaries, literary programs, all kinds of things. And what you're doing is enabling somebody else's creativity, essentially.
Yes.
And often what I would find is, particularly working with quite well-known people and making one-off programs with them, documentary-type programs, creative documentaries, that they would be very chaotic and would be firing off all over the place. And your job would be to rein it in and to make a story out of this chaos. Mm-hmm. And I'd been doing this for quite a long time, and I just wanted to do it myself. And so, you know, eventually I did.
And there's a delicious irony in that as well, because at the very beginning you were talking about how you feel that you're very chaotic within your own mindscape.
Yes.
In a good way. So very creative and lots of desire lines firing off different places and tangents. And yet you then had to make a job out of trying to contain other people's chaos or creativity.
Yeah, it is. It's true. It is true. And I think I'm quite good at just going to work, actually, and having a job and a job to do. I think I'm quite good at that. I think it's particularly when I'm on my own that everything comes shooting in. You know, I'm quite good when in the good old days when we used to catch trains to go to places, and yes. I'd have an hour on the train. You know, I could actually say, "Oh, I've got an hour on the train. That gives me enough time to write the notes on this script."
Yes, to gather your thoughts.
Gather my thoughts, or just to actually do a piece of work.
You know? Your train of thought. See what I did there.
on a train. But I did leave, and I will come to that. But the other thing I wanted to talk about that shaped me was the death of my father, which happened in 2001. And he had, my dad was amazing. He left school. I'm not entirely sure when he left school. I think it was 14, but I'm not sure whether school leaving age hadn't gone up at that stage. So I need to research that. But he left school very young. Maybe it was 15. And he went out to work. And he also started smoking. And he smoked throughout his life. And he was amazing. He was an engineer, of things, tool maker, actually. And he would work with, and he gradually became more and more successful within the company he was working for. He was promoted, and he got higher up in the company, and he ended up as a company director. I discovered that he was actually going to night school right into his 30s to get qualifications. So, you know, it's a very, very different world to the one that I grew up in. And he was always the voice of reason, and I could always phone him up. And I can remember when I said to him, I wanted to be a writer. He said, "Yes, but what are you going to write?" And that was him. He could, if he had a decision to make, he could write a list of the advantages and the disadvantages, and he could make a decision based on the list, because it would
based be based on logic and constancy. Because you said they were very still in their life and very pragmatic and planned.
Yes,
you mentioned they always knew what to eat, so very regimented in a way.
Yeah, And he could he was very logical and liked things that were logical and understood them, but he had smoked and he smoked. Yeah, I think he didn't stop until he was about 65. So by the time, you know, it perhaps wasn't a surprise when one day there was a phone call to say that there'd been he'd had an X-ray and there was a shadow on his lung, and he had lung cancer and he was operated on. But it was slightly too late and he died. So within quite a short space of time, he'd been part of us. He'd been in my house in the outside Bristol where I was living at the time, putting up a climbing frame for my daughter to not being there anymore. Yes. And, you know, and that did have a really profound effect, because I think we were very lucky in that. You know, I, as I say, I'm an only child, so I didn't have brothers or sisters. And there was a fairly sort of modest family group. But we went through my childhood right up to 2001 without any of that direct group having any sort of tragedy.
Okay, yes.
Then my father died. And then within 10 years, that whole general, with the exception of my mum, everybody had gone from that generation. So,
and how old were you in 2001? Because it's a really interesting moment of I suppose having to be a grown up from 2001, probably, even though you're a parent at the time as well.
Well, I was 38. I felt I was just 39. I was at 39 two days before he died. And so it was a very strange time. And it's no surprise now when I look back on it that within a year I'd left my job. My marriage to the mother of my Poppy and Fred, my children, had ended. I'd also been through another kind of episode of depression, and I'd gone hurtling down another road. It's not a surprise. And I think it does, you know, it had a profound effect. And that's why it's something that came into my mind immediately as something that shaped me.
And on chapter one of On the Road Not Taken, you do go straight to there. It's almost like that's the beginning moment. I know you play with the timeline beautifully within the book, and there's moments and chapters about 1976 and la la la. But 2001 is where you start, isn't it? I believe with your
it is, yeah.
Into
yeah.
your yes, with your father, yeah,
mm, yeah, yeah.
So we're still in the clearing, and we're talking about the things that have shaped you. So I think it's the fourth thing now that's shaped you.
So the fourth thing that shaped me is singing again. So I stopped singing when I was, I think, about 19 years old. I think I worked it out that I stopped singing in public, singing songs in public, I should say. I didn't stop singing altogether. I just stopped singing songs in public. And I wanted to sing ever since. You know, I wanted to sing. I would go to parties where people would sing and I would want to sing. I would stand and watch bands on stage and I would want to be standing there too, singing. And I didn't. And the longer I left it, the harder it became to actually sing. And I wrote songs I've written songs for other singers to sing that have, you know, ended up on records. I've written a lot for of lyrics and music for theatrical productions, and I would kind of apologize for my voice and say, this is the song, and croak it out to the actors and be apologetic. And I never actually had the confidence to stand and sing myself. And partly I think that songs are a way of explaining the world. It's songs I particularly love, and I think they are a way of explaining the world. And for me, it's a wonderful way of understanding things is through songs and music. And I wanted to be, as well as being on the receiving end of that, I wanted to be giving it out, and I wasn't. And I always thought I'd do it tomorrow. I thought, that's fine, I'll do it tomorrow. You know, I'd been in bands when I was young. We'd had a lovely kind of life in Kent with our band, the Entangled Network. And we got to, you know, we got to the point where we split up when I had to do my A-levels. And I hadn't found my way back to that, to actually performing live again.
And what do you attribute the sort of cork being put in your sort of genie gift of singing? Because I'm so happy that you have decided to, as you say,
yeah,
you're not just croaking it out. Your songs are incredibly lyrical. And because of your wisdom of your life's journey to now, they immediately, you know, go straight to an emotional core, which is, you know, very, very profound. Anyway, so what do you attribute the corking to, do you think?
The corking was, I think it was a sense of needing to be really good. As soon as I performed in front of anybody, needing to be perfect. And of course you're not perfect when you begin. You have to learn how to stand on stage and sing to people. For many performers, I mean, sometimes I talk to performers about this book and they say, well, why? It's just what you do. And I say, well, it's for a lot of people, it just isn't what you do. Yes. And it's a profoundly different thing. And you feel very exposed. There's something about your singing voice as opposed to your speaking voice that's very revealing. And it's almost like suddenly you're naked in front of people, you know, when you had all your clothes on beforehand.
It's the creative endeavor and the sort of exposure that really truly is, because you've got to step into the sunlight of judgment, I think, sometimes we can feel.
Yes.
And I
put the cork in. And the thing, I think, you know, I would sometimes be embarrassed about singing, and the embarrassment would result in a kind of momentary tone deafness, which would mean I'd start singing a line and it would be way off key and everybody would laugh, you know. And what I didn't realize for a long time was that you just have to learn it. You can just learn it and then you can sing in tune. You know, it's just a matter of practice.
Yes.
I sort of thought you either had it or you didn't. And there was this sense that you either had a good voice or you didn't have a good voice. And once I decided that I didn't have a good voice, the cork went in the bottle.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
And of course, the delicious irony is that as long as one is being authentic, your voice is always just perfect because it's authentically coming from.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Truth. A bit like an actor's choice and the choices that they make. And by the way, just one of the lyrics I just loved, and I've only found this yesterday, but the sky's a mess of contrails, but there's music in the air.
Oh.
And I just love that. And every time I tune into your lyrics, I'm just thinking, wow, I'm so happy that you've decided to be the lyricist. You've written numerous plays. I know you are a lyricist for others, but it's great you brought it back home. Yeah. So you're standing in the clearing with your own guitar now.
The lovely thing is about songs that they're not there. Nothing's there. And you sometimes have to go to work at it. Jason Isbell, the American singer-songwriter, says, you know, plumbers don't get plumber's block.
I love that. They're ballcock stuck or something.
Exactly, yeah. You have to go to work at writing songs. And I agree with that. You do. But sometimes there's some sort of impulse that comes along. There's something that starts the process off. And there's been nothing there. And then you work at it, and sometimes it just comes, but usually it's kind of like a sculpture. It's like making a sculpture out of a piece of wood, you know, and you're kind of chipping away at it. And then eventually it's there, and then it's there, and you can carry it around with you, and you can take it out, as I've done, to, you know, Berlin, and you can sing it in a bar in Berlin at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you can take it to the Scilly Isles and sing it there, and you can take it up to somebody's living room in Yorkshire, and you can sing it there. And this thing kind of travels around with you, this little universe that you've made. And it's a really satisfying.
That's a lovely full circle in the fact that back in the producer days, people just give you sort of tones of Mandarin, and yet you can make it go into the world by, I'll broadcast that then. So there is a way of just, you know, the transferable currency of music being, you know, the currency of all culture.
Everything
can all relate to music. It either resonates or it doesn't, and we can all relate to it.
And I think the extraordinary thing is that, you know, I probably did start this process thinking, well, maybe, you know, I'll be standing up there with Bruce Springsteen, you know, on Wembley Stadium stage, somewhere far back in my mind. And then in a pub in Bristol on Friday night when I was supporting on a rainy Friday night when I was supporting Kid Carpet and somebody else. I was at the bottom of the bill, and I'm sort of standing there, and there's half a dozen people sitting watching me, and people, more and more people arriving and talking in the background. You realize actually that's not going to happen. You know, you've got a long way to go, but there are those six people sitting there watching you, and that's the thing, you know.
Yes, that's connection.
Focus on.
And totally relatable, by the way, because in my world of comedy improvisation, you know, there have been times when I'm performing to like a tortoise and a stoat, it feels, in the middle of nowhere. And then other times there's, you know, potentially, you know, if in a different setting, there could be hundreds of people there.
And it is exactly. I would say probably for me, it's more often the fewer than the tortoise than the hundreds, but they are still there. And you have to sort of, and what I've had to do is to sort of redefine the idea of success.
Absolutely. Yes, it's totally relative. It's all about, that's, again, beautifully relatable. Absolutely.
And what is wonderful is that one of the... So I made a record, and the record... the record includes a song that I wrote for my daughter when she left home. And
it's a copy song, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was a sort of manifesto, my little sort of manifesto for her to take out into the world. And what is amazing is that that song has been playlisted on Spotify. So the way kind of music grows now is it used to be kind of radio play used to be the thing. And now it's Spotify playlists as well are really important. And it's a song that has found its way on to playlists all around the world. And has been, and as I speak, it's just approaching something like 27,000 listens.
Congratulations. And if I may, I think it is a perfect song. And it doesn't surprise me it's on a playlist. Anyone who has my daughter's 21, has recently gone to university. Anyone who can relate to the fact their child is about to step into the world, you know, wherever you may roam, this will always be a home for you. It's just so beautiful. And I love the fact that Poppy in the song also has her own graffiti tag, "Know that you're alive." And I now know that I've walked past that.
Have you?
In Bristol a lot. And I'm going to go looking for it again. But it is a beautiful song, Poppy's song.
Oh, yeah. So thank you. So
there's a light at my window and wherever you may roam. And it's your, so you tell us the lyric.
Just to explain why that you have seen that as a graffiti tag is that I asked Poppy to make the video for the song. And so I just said, can you go and make the video for the song and edit it and bring it back to me? Because I quite like not appearing in them, you see. And because I can do that. That's the other thing. I don't have to because it's, you know, I'm at this stage in my life. And so she went and filmed this, and there's this lyric in it, "Know that you're alive." And if I could tell you just one thing, it's to know that you're alive. And she went and put that in various places around the city and filmed herself painting it on bridges and various things.
Where I recognise a lot of the infrastructure of where she's put them, and I'm going to go looking to see if it's still there.
If it's still there, yeah, because that was in 2019, I think. So it'd be interesting to see whether somebody's come along and put it over the top.
And she's very, very talented in her filmmaking as well. And I know your son, Fred, is also a musician now as well. So I think whatever you're doing as a parent, too, you're really encouraging them to follow their creative and artistic bliss.
Well, of course, talking of parenting, I mean, I've been at a distance from them throughout their life because, when Fred was quite young, I split up with their mum. And so we would spend a lot of time together, but a lot of credit must go to Poppy and Fred's mum, I have to say.
Oh, wonderfully generous of you. But what's so clear is your own profound connection. Because as I say, Poppy's song, for me, it is just a perfect song. I just thought, wow. And I felt, you know, I was saying to Janie, my wife, over breakfast, actually, in the time I've been researching this, I've developed, if I may, a bit of a man crush for you. I think it's so good. Because you're like a gentle Bob Dylan in what it is you sound like, and you probably don't want to be boxed at all. But it's incredibly lyrical with just beautiful lyrics within there. There's also something about diamonds of Brislington, diamonds at my feet.
Brislington diamonds, yeah. Well, that's there's a song called Brislington Diamonds. And that was just a phrase that there is some connection with Richard Coles, you know, the Reverend Richard Coles, who...
Oh, gosh.
I'm not sure what I believe. A friend of mine was producing a program with Richard Coles, and I think what happened was they were walking along the road, and there was some broken glass on the pavement in Bristol, and apparently he looked down and pointed at it and said, "Brislington diamonds," broken glass from a car window.
Do you know what's so extraordinary? In 5 degrees of separation, I thought about the Reverend Richard Coles this morning, thinking, "Gosh, I'd really like to be able to sort of send him the podcast just to see what he thinks about it." But it's just so extraordinary that Brislington Diamonds, that story. But also,
yeah, I don't know whether I remember that, but I don't know whether I've remembered it correctly, but that's where it came from, the memory of that.
I love that broken glass in Brisbane, because also I made a dark comic short film called Knock Knock, which was set in Brislington.
Do you know, I've seen that. Yes, that's right. That's
Chris
great.
Bianchi.
Yes.
Anyway, that was someone almost crunching, as you say, through the Brislington diamonds to go and get their fix of the day, which is what the film is about in a sort of quirky way. Anyway, I love that. Beautiful stuff. And so now I think we've come to the four things that have shaped you.
Yes.
And now it's three things that inspire you.
Yes. Okay. Okay. So I'm going to talk, first of all, about Laurie Lee. And I'm going to use Laurie Lee as a gateway into life writing. Not so much. I've talked quite a lot about myself and life writing. So I'm going to talk about the value of life writing, because I think it has immense value in the world. Laurie Lee, poet and memoirist, who indeed wrote Cider with Rosie.
Yes, he did.
The adaptation that we were both in 1998.
By the way, I know by heart the first, the opening of the book Cider with Rosie, because it struck me in a similar way. So I'm really intrigued to know.
I think the opening of Cider with Rosie and also the next one, which was the next book he wrote, which was As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning, that describes him leaving his home in the Cotswolds and walking initially to Southampton because he'd never seen the sea, then going back to London and working as a labourer in London for 18 months or so, and then travelling across Spain with a violin on his back, and eventually getting caught up in the Spanish Civil War and being rescued from the beaches by the Royal Navy in the 1930s. I think he leaves in 1934. And both of those books, the first two pages, I think are perfect examples of how to tell life story, because they are full of movement, sensory detail, of showing, not telling, and yet at the same time are full of the context that you need to understand the bigger story.
Beautifully put, by the way. I completely agree with all of that.
And Laurie Lee is, when I read, particularly As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning, which deals with him as he's 19 when he left home. So he's sort of 19, 20, 21 as he's moving across Spain. Some of the attitudes to race and objectification of women, you know, are very much of products of another age. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, the way he writes, the way he describes things is extraordinary. And he then went on to write a little essay about what he called autobiography, life writing, memoir, autobiography are kind of interchangeable terms. And there is a sentence in this essay, which I keep on my walls, so I'm going to look up and find it now, which I think explains why it's so important. Autobiography can be the laying to rest of ghosts, as well as an ordering of the mind. But for me, it is also a celebration of living and an attempt to hoard its sensations.
And that perfect definition of autobiography, borrowed from an essay by Laurie Lee, brings us to the end of time, sadly, listening to Paul Dodgson Storysmith here on The Good Listening To Show, Stories of Distinction and Genius. If you'd like to listen to the end of the episode, go straight along to Buzzsprout to hear it now, or you can hear it on the UK Health Radio podcast too. But as I say, sadly, that brings us to the end of time for today. So tune in next week for more stories from the clearing here on UK Health Radio. And good night.
You've been listening to The Good Listening To Show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son. If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, from me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
And goodbye.